nodded approval. I will be coordinating with all of you and making loud arguments in some very powerful ears about the critical need to keep the team together.
Well, fuck, Kampar said, then shrugged his thick shoulders. Palace intrigue isn't how I was hoping to spend my break, but skulking in shadows and interrogating spies won't be boring, I suppose.
Sorry, Daffod said, though he wasn't quite sure why he was the one apologizing. Elsa's initial smile was brief and weary, but when she turned to Daffod, it grew warmer. One dimple in her left cheek, two in her right. This is hard, but I can't imagine how much worse it would have been to find out when it was already decided and there wasn't anything we could do about it.
Just here for the team, Daffod said.
Else leaned forward, squeezed his wrist. Daffod felt himself responding to the touch and didn't try to prolong it, even though a simple animal part of him wanted nothing more. He noticed that the girl with the sandwich was gone.
Now, Tanner said, let's plan out how to make the approaches. I don't want to leave any of this to chance, not with the stakes this high.
Noel cleared his throat and lifted a finger. Tanner's frown deepened, but when he spoke, there was no anger in his voice.
You have something?
Yes, the old scholar associate said. Have we ruled out asking them?
Chapter 4.
It's true,
Rickard Damatin said, spreading his hands in a little deprecating gesture.
What can you do?
Tanner felt his fists clenching and made a conscious effort to release them. Their laboratory hadn't changed. It felt like any day of the last 8 months. The north wall was still covered in their notes and lists. The tables had trays of reaction assays stacked 5 deep. The air smelled like compost and cleaning fluid. They could have been talking through any problem on the project. Given that everything they'd tried to build was now coming apart, the sameness felt obscene. Tanner looked around at the others. Irina, newly arrived from her parents' home in Abasat, was the only one who looked dumbfounded. Noel seemed sorrowful, in the way he always was. The others, Jessen, Sinia, Kampar, Daffod, and Else, were a spectrum of disappointment and anger. Ricker boosted himself up onto the work table and leaned forward, resting his arms on his thighs, fingers laced together like he was waiting for questions, giving them time to process. Kampar was the first to gather himself.
Well, that's a remarkably casual way to detonate the most important project of our lives.
Tanner appreciated the acid in the man's voice.
It wasn't my idea, Ricker said, or my choice. Samar Austad is the chief administrator at Dayan. He's the one pushing it with the colloquy, not me.
But you went along with it, Tanner said. You agreed.
Of course I did, Ricker said. What else would I do?
Refuse the position, Tanner said. Tell him you won't accept it if offered.
Ricker's shrug had a depth of world-weary resignation.
This isn't how I wanted things to be, but it's the way things are. If I had my pick, I'd have kept the group as it is for another few years and had Medri and Collegia competing to give me a laboratory. But it didn't happen that way. It happened this way. And the reed that doesn't bend breaks.
This is my project, Tanner said, and took a step forward.
The rage he'd felt for the last days felt thick in his throat. Ricker just tilted his head. Else stood up. We are the most celebrated researchers on the planet right now. We are, as a group, a team. If we're scattered, that won't be true anymore.
I didn't ask Austad to do this, but he's good at what he does.
He wouldn't have made the proposal if he didn't have the support to make it work. It may take a few more days, but this is going to happen.
What happens to the rest of us? Jessen asked.
We'll find other placements, Noel said. We'll have status for a moment. The next year, someone will have us. After that, who can say?
Sinia put a hand on the older man's arm, comforting or counseling him to silence, or both.
It's not your lab yet, Tanner said. Until the colloquy votes, it's still mine.
It is, Ricker agreed.
For a few days, anyway.
So get the hell out of it. Ricker eased himself back off the table, his feet touching the floor gently, like he was trying not to make noise. He pressed his hands into his pockets and walked carefully out toward the common halls. His apologetic manner felt like an act, the performance of a man sure enough of his victory to be magnanimous. The door closed behind him with a click, and the others were quiet. Kampar broke the silence with an angry chuckle.
I didn't know about any of this, Irina said, taking a step toward Tanner, her hands tied at her waist. She looked very young and pale with worry.
I know, Else said. No one thinks you did.
I really didn't.
Tanner turned away. His lab seemed quieter than it should have. The workstations with their shelves stained by years of soil uptake dyes, the wall screens all dark now with the maintenance of the term break, the thin windows spilling milky light across the gray tiled floor. It was his kingdom, and even though he'd spent more time in these rooms than in his home, it felt like he hadn't seen it. The threat of losing it washed all the familiarity away and left it before him like he had stepped into it for the first time.
It's not over yet, Tanner said. The colloquy hasn't decided anything. We can still keep this from happening.
What do you have in mind? Jessen asked.
Call in all our favors. Promise new ones. If all of us reach out to our old leads and advisors, we can flood the caucus with objections. Drown Ricker's sponsor, he snapped his fingers, trying to recall Ricker's words.
Samar Austad, Irina said. His name is Samar Austad.
Drown him in outrage. Let him see how much this move will cost him.
Daffod made a small noise. Another day, in a different mood, Tanner would have ignored it, but he was frustrated and upset.
What?
Daffod met his eyes, then looked away. When he spoke, his voice was calm enough. Going loud is an option, but it can backfire. The colloquy's wary of letting popularity campaigns affect decisions. They think it encourages people to arrange more campaigns later. They don't want to deal with those.
You're an expert on research administration? Tanner snapped, and then remembered again who the boy's family was.
If there isn't a quieter way, we can always go loud, Daffod said. But once we've gone loud, we can't go quiet.
Is it worth doing at all? Noel asked. If the fight's as good as lost already, it might be wiser not to make waves, yes?
No, his wife said, and Tanner was pleased to hear the certainty in her voice.
No, good things are rare. They're worth fighting for.
How would you approach this, Daffod? Else asked. The research assistant paused, thought. It was all Tanner could do not to interrupt him.
I'd talk to people near the caucus, see who Austad's allies are and who he's crossed. If we know who his enemies are, there might be a way to put up a counterproposal, something that pulls his coalition apart or puts together a stronger one. We'll still lose something. We always lose something, but giving a different way forward is a stronger argument than just saying no to the one that's on the table.
Harder for Dian Academy to counter. More likely to change the conversation.
We don't have time, Tanner said.
Could you do it in 2 days? Else asked, as if Tanner hadn't spoken. The boy met Else's gaze, blushed a little, and nodded like he'd just been given a quest. As project lead, Tanner had gotten first choice in housing. His instinct had been an old instructor's cottage with worn bamboo floors and the smell of mildew that never quite vanished, even with remediation. It wasn't that he liked the place, but it was closest to the labs. If he'd followed that impulse, he would have saved himself almost half an hour each day. But Else had complimented one of the newer coral-grown buildings, and one apartment in particular with a balcony that looked north over a long, curving street. She had just abandoned her own project to join his team. They had been in the first blush of their relationship, and he'd hoped that by living in a space she enjoyed, he would encourage her to spend more of her nights with him. She wasn't project lead, and her official rooms were in the basement levels of an old ecosphere an hour's walk to the south. She was almost never there, but she used it to store some things. He stepped out to the balcony he'd gotten just for her, and sat in the chair beside hers. Tanner found Else endlessly fascinating, and only more so because of her few bad habits, one of them being her fondness for smoking. The fact that he found her so attractive in spite of it made her seem all the more exotic and exciting. The little brown roll of paper and herbs between her fingers smelled of marijuana and clove. He didn't mean to grimace, but she saw it anyway and shifted the cigarette to her far hand.
Looking at the stars?
Looking at whatever there is to look at, she said. The night was cloudless, but a haze caught the lights from the Medri's research complex, the shipyards to the west, the sprawl of the city beyond. The spill of stars was less than a clear night would offer, and still millions. He watched them glimmer for a while, the stars above and the homes and streets and buildings below, like the tiny corner of their world could mirror the cosmos, if only you stood at the right place to see it.
Do you ever regret going into research? He asked.
Sometimes, Else answered. I would have been good in practical applications, too. I worked at an aquaculture farm for 6 months between primary and advanced, mostly cleaning the sea tanks. I was hell on kelp.
You would have been great, but I'm glad you chose not to stay there.
Three lights, two pale yellow and one blinking orange, rose up from the city. A transport for Oberon or Glencoe. He could imagine it was a star trying to get back to the sky. He'd believed stories like that when he was a child, and some part of him still did. The thing that children didn't understand and that adults forgot was that stories like that were all analogies at heart.
You would have wound up in management, he said. You'd be in a colloquy by now.
I'm not a politician. All the best administrators are politicians. Like Alcor. She's good at what she does. I didn't mean the aunt. I meant yours, the boy. Else took a long drag on her cigarette. The ember glowed a deeper orange than the transport, then faded to gray. When she spoke, soft white smoke spilled out of her.
Are you angry with me for taking his side?
He's a research assistant. Research assistants haven't earned the right to have a side. She lifted the cigarette toward her lips again, paused, then licked the finger and thumb of her other hand and pinched out the ember before flicking the rest away into the darkness. She didn't speak. Tanner knew it would be better to keep quiet himself as well. He managed for a while. I know all of you like him, but I don't trust him. He's a schemer. Everything he does is for effect. He's always watching people. Her smile was so brief and understated, he might only have imagined it. I think he's charming. And schemer or not, I've never seen him be cruel.
Ah, so I'm being cruel now.
Tell me again how you aren't angry with me.
I'm not. I'm not angry with you, Tanner said. And then, I'm just angry. And you're here. So I'm being a little shit.
Else considered. That sounds right.
If Rickard does this, if they take the project away from me...
She shifted to see him better. When she spoke, it was a challenge, but a gentle one. Finish that thought. If you lose the project, what?
Tanner leaned forward, ran his hands through his hair. The transport light switched from orange to green. This work is what I am. If I don't have it, I'm not sure what's left of me. I know that all the literature talks about reinvention and remaking your career every 10 years, but I don't know if I have it in me to start over. Does that make sense?
Else's eyes narrowed. A little smile touched her lips, but her gaze wasn't on him. She was seeing something internal. When she did this, retreated into her own thoughts without including him in on what they were, it left him anxious.
You understand how much this is, he said, filling her silence. You gave up more than anyone to be part of it. You had your own project. You were lead.
She waved the thought away with two fingers, like her hand had forgotten there wasn't still a cigarette between them. Spiral analysis was a dead end. Everyone knew that. I could jump ship or spend my career driving coffin nails. I was glad to get that number two spot on your team. It was a very rational choice.
And you are nothing if not rational.
It had more bite in it than he'd intended, but she wouldn't be baited. Else stood, lifted her arms over her head and stretched to one side and then the other. When she turned back, heading into the rooms, she touched his shoulder. It wasn't an invitation, but it was intimate. A private idiom between the two of them that the day was over. Tanner wondered whether he'd be able to sleep. He was weary, yes, but he wasn't tired. She drew her hand back and went inside. He listened to her start the shower, heard the change in the sound of the splashing as she washed the day off her skin. The transport vanished over the horizon. A formation of high-altitude ships tracked overhead, national security or deep survey, he couldn't tell which. The shower turned off. He thought about going in. Then he thought about Ricker. His jaw ached. He could imagine himself sitting there, staring into darkness until the dawn came up. And then... what? Wait patiently for a research assistant to save the project for him? That sounded like a thin slice of hell. Else touched his shoulder again. He hadn't heard her coming up behind him. She passed a glass forward, one finger of rich amber whiskey in it.
Brooding won't help, she said. Come inside. Relax. Get some sleep. Things will seem better in the morning.
He took the glass, sipped the liquor. The first warm bloom spread through his throat and chest.
I hate losing. I hate being embarrassed.
I know.
Alcor has a crush on you.
I know that too. He drained the glass in a swallow and set it on the tile beside his chair. It would be there to clean away in the daylight.
The rooms were grown in light green and yellow that made him feel like an insect sleeping inside a flower. It was oddly comforting. Else was already on her side of the bed, curled under the sheet with her head turned away. Tanner shut off the lights, stripped in the darkness, and climbed in. He didn't think sleep would come, but as soon as his head touched the pillow, he felt himself swimming. In his dream, he was trying to get across the square to his labs, but the paving stones were falling away into a vast pit. Every step was dangerous, and the ground collapsed behind him or where he'd been about to go as the world ate itself under him. Later, it would seem like a premonition.
Chapter 5. Seen one way, the night is dark. Viewed another, it is bright. Another, symphonic in its complexity of radiations all along the spectrum of wavelengths. The swarm is as still as it can be, vibrating within the unfamiliar skin of its new host, and it receives. It is aware of a body on the other side of the thick coral wall, of the cacophony of insects in the soil and air, of the brief, sudden lines of cosmic rays passing through the planet like rain falling slantwise. The awareness is exhausting, and the exhaustion is part of what it seeks. The new host is unwieldy, cunning, alive, and aware in a way the old one was not. This is a surprise for the swarm, but it expects to be surprised. The swarm is young in the universe. Consciousness is a mystery it is only beginning to experience. The body on the other side of the wall moves, standing taller than before. The swarm retreats, concerned that its radio bounce has been noticed, but when it looks again, the body in the building has only moved across the room. The swarm relaxes, and it notices that it relaxes. Not the host, but itself. The new host pushes, is restless, fights. That isn't what captures the swarm's half-autonomic attention. It turns its mind inward and finds things there. A fondness for sweet pickles, the memory of a boy named Elio, a resignation to the inevitability of death. They do not come from the swarm or the host. The swarm recognizes artifacts of Amir kindred. That girl is gone. The swarm finds this unnerving, and by doing so, discovers that it can find things unnerving. It was built to learn, built for plasticity. Its design is like water, flowing through whatever channels the universe provides it. It understands now that water also carries what it passes through. It has already traded purity for experience, and there is no path back, nor should there be. Time is short. That is a blessing and a curse. Anything it does now that lasts a month is as good as something made to last a lifetime. A month is all the lifetime many of the people on this world have left. But neither can it wait in the shadows any longer. A door slides open, and the swarm realizes it has been distracted by internal stimuli. It looks for the figure beyond the wall, and the figure is gone. A man steps out into the symphonic darkness. He is older, white hair shaved close to his scalp. He has a long face and pale stubble. His eyes are hooded, amused, weary. The swarm wonders what it would learn if it took him,
traded its current host for him. It will never know. The man sees it, hesitates. The swarm steps forward on its borrowed legs. It smiles. Samar Austad?
Yes, the man says. How can I help you?
The swarm, or the host, or the girl that is gone, thinks, what a question. He thought it was me, Irina said.
Really?
He wasn't sure what to think, Jessen replied. The courtyard, while technically public, was empty. Most of the scholars were still away on break, and the maintenance and support staff were using the emptiness to repair and refurbish and regrow the labs and dormitories, not the parks and squares and courtyards. Jessen liked this one particularly. It had tile work in blue and yellow all along its walls, ferns from both trees of life that unfolded in the summers and died back in the cold. During most of the year, a kitchen along its west side gave out meals of polenta and spiced beans made by an old man from Hauner. The windows were closed and dark now, but she could remember the flavors and the old man's smile, and it left her fond of the place. I just, Irina said, and ran her fingers through her pale hair as a kind of punctuation. It was the sort of thing she trusted Jessen to understand. Then, with a sigh, do you think Tanner can find a way to stop it? With anyone else, Jessen would have been politic. A shrug or a careful phrase like, Tanner is very intelligent, but this is outside his field. Instead, no. Not even with Daffod? With an Alcor on our team, even nepotism has limits. He isn't just asking to keep us together as a favor, Irina said. It's all a political game, isn't it? Finding who'd lose if Dian wins. How to make the colloquy see all the good that keeping us together would do. Things like that. Isn't that how the world works? I don't know. I find social intrigue exhausting. I like research, where things are quantifiable and falsifiable. There was a pause. It seemed to mean something. Irina looked up at the tiles, her eyes gliding from one to the next like she was reading them. When she spoke, she sounded like she was trying so hard to be casual that it didn't work. Would you take a project of your own, if they offered it to you? That was a hard question. It shouldn't have been. Taking a research lead of her own would mean leaving Irvian, which meant leaving Jellit. And if her brother wasn't there, who would she go to when her brain went rotten again? Her brother had been there since she was an anxious, moody child. He knew her internal weather by experience. When the darkness started coming on, when the back of her mind got angry and loud, he knew without her having to say anything. He knew when to leave her alone and when to step in. He had reached out to her physicians at least twice when she'd gotten too bad to do it herself. They hid it, but her brother was also her caretaker, her nurse, an extra part of her brain that stayed sane on those occasions when her own mind betrayed her. Jellit had his own career, his own work, and she'd thought, hoped, pretended, that by being placed at Irvian together, she'd be able to put off this particular moment of truth for a few more years, maybe forever. She wouldn't ask him to leave his career for her, wouldn't accept it from him if he offered, but the idea of living without him frightened her. So, would she take a project of her own? I don't know, she said, trying for a lightness she didn't feel. There's a certain peacefulness to not jumping for the prize. I look at Noel and Sinia. They've been fixtures here for decades, moving from one project to the next, having a home.
That's worth something, too. Irina's smile turned inward. It hadn't been the answer her friend was looking for. She was hoping that Jessen would say yes, would ask her to come with her, that they could continue their careers together someplace. And Jessen had just told her no. Noel and Sinia and you too, Irina said a little bitterly. Ricker's going to have a strong base. If Noel and Sinia stay. It was a weak counter, and they both knew it. Nothing's going to pry them out of here. They're both going to die in Irvian, Irina said through a laugh. At least she was laughing. Probably true. I just thought we'd have longer. I don't know. That being the top of the lists would make things better for us somehow, instead of turning everything to shit. Even if we're reassigned, Jessen said, even if they scatter us across the world, we'll still be working the same field, coordinating research, sharing results. It's not the same, though, is it? I like going into the lab and finding us. You know what I mean? I do. But everything changes, doesn't it? You have a good moment, and then there's another moment after it, and another one after that. Nothing stays the same. Even if, Jessen said, you know you can always reach me, even if we're working different labs, or Kampar, or else. Even Tanner will probably return our messages. Not Ricker's. Jessen chuckled. No, probably not Ricker's. Jessen didn't know what to say, so she shifted forward, taking the younger woman's hand in hers. They sat there for a long moment, neither of them speaking, both aware of the loss that each of them was suffering in her own way. Irina squeezed her hand and let her go. Her eyes were bright with tears that hadn't quite fallen. I should, Irina said, gesturing at the world beyond the courtyard. I have some things too, Jessen lied as they stood. But it was good seeing you. Maybe Tanner will take his project to Abasat, and I can see my parents every weekend. They'd like that. We can hope for the best, without being too specific about it. Hope for the best, Irina agreed, and then she was gone. Jessen shoved her fists into her pockets and waited for a long breath, then another, giving Irina time to get ahead and avoid the awkwardness of walking together and also apart. When she got home, she keyed herself in, dropped her jacket on the front table. Jellet's voice came from the back balcony, and she walked toward it, her melancholy driving her forward. He was talking in bright, excited, animated tones, which could mean good news on his project, or a new book coming out by a poet he enjoyed, or that he'd just woken up in a sunny mood. He could do that. When is the run going to finish up? He said as she stepped out. The face on the screen was one of his cohort in astronomical imaging. A man named... she didn't remember. She sat on one of the little wooden chairs at the far end by the railing and let herself be still and small. The other man was saying something in equally breathless tones. She looked down at the street and imagined a life where she ran her own project, where Irina was waiting at her laboratory, the old friend she'd brought with her. It would have been a pretty life, if it had been possible, if she had a head that worked a little better than hers did, if she were better. All right, Jellet said. I'll be there, but I have to go now. He dropped the connection. The balcony became very quiet. Bad day? Her brother asked. Jessen shook her head. Not no, but let's not talk about it. What was that all about? You have a data set running on break? I thought I was the only one having high drama when I should be resting. We have a data set running, Jellet agreed. It may be nothing, or it might also be the most important thing in thousands of years. Kind of one or the other. Not lots of middle ground. She chuckled and he relaxed.
It was part of the subtle language they had with each other. If she could still laugh at him, she wasn't that bad. If she wasn't that bad, he could worry a little less. If he could worry less, then maybe so could she. "I'm all a flutter," she said dryly. "What's your 1,000-year discovery?" "You know about the lensing effect. The one that whatever his name from Dion was talking about? Ricker's friend?" "Lauren Morse. Him. I went and talked with my people, and they talked with his people, and between us all, we got permission to refocus a couple of asteroid mappers and fire some broad-spectrum radio at it. We got what looks like a return right between infrared and microwave. There's structure inside the effect." Jessen felt her self-pity shift. Not go away, that would be too easy, but lose a little of its hold as her attention moved elsewhere. "Structure? Mass, anyway, but yes, ordered mass, and as far as we can tell, non-exotic. So, not a naked singularity or macroscale quantum inflation. Probably titanium and carbon. We're trying to get a better image now," Jellit said. His voice was getting smooth, the way it did when he was slipping into the best part of his mind. Her brother could be oblivious to people who weren't her. He could come across as frivolous, but was intelligent and as expert in his field as Tanner was in hers. Maybe more. It was a pleasure to watch her brother descend into the flow of his understanding. His eyes softened, and a little smile played across his lips. "What are you thinking?" "That it's unlikely non-exotic matter would generate lensing like this just at random. So it's not a given, but if the signals are confirmed, I'm going to bet this is non-random." "Designed?" "Designed," Jellit said. "It could be a probe." "From where?" Jellit answered with a shrug and a grin. "But we're aliens on this world. Maybe it's our long-lost brothers come to find us." In the street below them, three men walked abreast, laughing together. A white bird the size of a fist flew up, hovered, and then darted away again. All thoughts of colloquy politics and research careers and lost chances at friendship or love faded, and Jessen put her fingertips to her lips. "Wow," she said. "The run ends in half an hour. I don't know what we'll know then, but we'll know something." He said it softly. The part he didn't say, she still heard. "But if you need me here, I'll stay." Jessen shifted, pointed back over her shoulder toward the door. "Go, find out. Get back to me as soon as you find out. This is amazing." Jellit's grin was relief and pleasure and the giddiness that comes maybe once or twice in a lifetime when something miraculous happens. He kissed the top of her head, grabbed his satchel, and was gone. A minute later, she saw him running down the street under the balcony, long, thin limbs flailing like it was his first day with them. When she sat back, she was smiling. It took a moment to understand why. Growing up, Jessen's family had attended a Sarantist church led by an old, white-haired priest named Nan Sui. When, as an adolescent, she'd been struggling with the intrusive thoughts and anxiety, she'd tried going to him for help. Nan Sui had been a patient, thoughtful, kind man. The conversations they'd had left questions of theology and doctrine behind very quickly. Mostly he'd listened. And when he did talk, it was often about the difficulty of living as a very small part of a very large universe. He'd told her a story once of his religious conversion. He said he'd been in a place similar to where she'd been at the time, young, confused, disturbed. "Too much with myself," was the phrase he'd used. He'd gone to a meditation retreat and been told to practice walking,
until he could feel every fiber of his socks pressing against his feet with each step. She still remembered the warmth and amusement in his voice, describing his younger self, trying to focus and getting bored and distracted and angry, and then turning back to his socks. And, on the third day, he'd had an experience that changed his life. Between one step and the next, he'd had an epiphany about the vastness and strangeness of the universe and his place in it. The insignificance of one boy on a strange planet in the vastness of galaxies. For a moment, his mind had reached out to the farthest ends of the universe, and he'd felt the weight of his life, his ego, his struggles, as less than a feather. "Then I came back to myself and refocused on my sock," he'd said. And they'd both laughed. This was different, but related. Her life was a mess. Her career was a mess. Normal people would succeed where she couldn't because she'd been born a little broken. But there was also a world outside her head that was filled with mystery and exploration and unexpected things to discover. Looked at in a wide enough frame, maybe her problems weren't so large. They just seemed that way when she held them up against her eyes, where they'd block out all the light. She sat on the balcony, enjoying the feeling of calm and release and wonder, until her belly felt empty enough to distract her with ideas about food. She put it off, though. She didn't want the moment to end. When her system chimed, she was so sure it would be Jellet that she didn't check before she accepted the connection. The face that appeared on the floating screen was wide-eyed with worry. "Kumpar," she said.
"Jessen. Yes, good. We need to have a conversation. You may be contacted by the security forces."
"Wait, why?"
"Samar Austad's been killed."
Chapter 6. "So, help me understand, you were asking around about him," the security forces man said, "but you'd never met him."
"That's right," Daffod said, "not for the first time. We heard that Dian Academy was making a proposal about our work group, and I was trying to understand better what that entailed."
The room was small and spare, but not threatening. Natural light, soft chairs, no table. The security forces man made a show of being at ease, a little uncertain, even just on the edge of befuddled by the whole thing. All it meant to Daffod was that they weren't trying to scare him into implicating himself in the man's death so much as lull him into it. Scaring him would have been more effective. He was already scared.
"What that entailed?"
the security man repeated, making it a question. Daffod recognized the technique, and it put him more on his guard, if that was possible. "If there were any changes, I wanted to be ready for them."
"Ready for them?"
"Yep," he said with a smile, and then let the silence stretch. The security man looked across at him with a blank, generic friendliness until it was clear Daffod wasn't planning to elaborate.
"So, what all did you find out?"
"Well, I just found out he's dead, so nothing I learned matters much, I guess." He didn't feel as light as his words. Between the time the security forces arrived at his rooms and when he'd left with them, he'd managed to send word to his aunt and Tonner. That had been 5 hours ago, and he hadn't heard back from either. That almost certainly meant that they weren't being permitted to contact him. It made all the warmth and calm and ease of the questioning feel like the trap it was. The security man furrowed his brow.
"Does that make you upset?"
"A little nervous, maybe," Daffod said.
"Is it related to the girl?"
"Girl?"
I heard that there was a girl who died over break. You were talking to my team lead about it. Tanner Freiss? The security man's smile gave away nothing.
We're looking into things.
Why do you think they'd be related?
They're both dead, Daffet said. I don't know how I can help.
Tell me again about these changes that had you worried. I wouldn't say worried. Curious, then.
Daffet spread his hands. I heard there might be some changes, and I was curious what they might be.
The other man chuckled, but there was a glint in his eye.
You play your cards pretty close to the vest, don't you, Mr. Alcor?
I don't have any cards, I'm just... The door opened, and an older man leaned in. He made eye contact with Daffod's interrogator, then retreated, leaving the door ajar behind him. The security man heaved himself up from his chair, letting his frustration show a little in his posture.
I'll be right back. Do you want anything? Coffee? Cigarette?
I'm fine. The door closed behind him. Daffod fought the impulse to relax. There were almost certainly still eyes on him, even if the cameras weren't obvious. He tried to arrange himself into looking placid and complacent, the way he imagined an innocent man would look, which was a little weird because he was innocent. The death of Samar Austad had nothing to do with him, or the apparently not quite as subtle as he'd hoped inquiries he'd been making.
Anything he did would be how an innocent man acted by definition.
But the whole situation made him anxious. It left him trying to seem like what he was, which he was pretty sure made him seem inauthentic, which was probably why the security forces thought he was hiding something.
Overthinking it, he said to himself.
And then, in case someone was listening too, just keep telling everyone the truth, and it'll be fine.
God, he thought, I wasn't cut out for this.
The door opened again, and a woman he hadn't seen before walked in. She gestured for him to stand, and he did. After a moment, she shook her head.
You can go, she said, and repeated her gesture.
That means you can go.
Oh, all right, I didn't...
Thank you. She escorted him through the tall, thin corridors of the security services building. The walls rose up three times his height, curving into a Gothic arch at the top with ridges like the ribs of a giant snake that had devoured him. In other contexts, it would have been beautiful. The waiting area was open and broad, with wooden benches that reminded him of pews. People sat or paced or leaned against the walls, all waiting for whatever the next step was in their personal journey through the security forces' bureaucracy. The light was artificial, bluer than sunlight and cold-feeling. The air smelled like old cigarette smoke and cleaning solution. His aunt was perched at the edge of one bench like it was an unwelcome acquaintance. When she saw him, she rose. When she nodded to the security services woman, it was like a dismissal. I arranged private transport, his aunt said. There are journalists.
For me?
She turned and started walking. He had to trot to catch up. I mean, journalists exist, and our name should stay out of this as much as can be managed. I've got enough on my plate as it is. As hard as it may be to believe, this is not my top concern right now. They stepped out of the building and into a wide plaza where a transport stood waiting like a giant pillbug. The plates parted, and his aunt stepped in and took a rear-facing seat.
Daffod took one across from her.
Do we know what happened? He asked as the transport juddered into motion.
How did he die?
You don't think it had anything to do with the research group, do you? His aunt didn't answer, already involved with spooling through the messages waiting on her system. The transport turned a corner, shifting him to the side, then back again. He didn't like
closed transports. They left him a little nauseated. His aunt made a soft grunt like she'd been punched and leaned forward, her whole attention on a message Dafydd couldn't see. "This wasn't us," he said. "Whatever it is, it wasn't Tanner's group." "Do you know who killed him?" she asked, not looking up. "No? Then you can say it wasn't you. Us is a big word. You can fit surprises in it." She flipped to another message and muttered an obscenity under her breath. "I have to let you out here. Can you walk the rest of the way?" "Sure, yes. What's the matter?" "That list is too long right now," she said, tapping the transport controls. "I'll tell you what I can when I can." The transport stopped. The plate slid open. Dafydd didn't get out. "I understand. Just, what will this do to Dian Academy's proposal? I know that's a minor thing for you, but it matters to me a lot." She shook her head, but not as a refusal. "There was pushback before. Without Samar to champion it, it won't happen. But the damage is done. You understand that?" Dafydd found himself caught between relief and dread. "I do," he said. He pulled himself up and out to the walkway. The morning sun was cooler than he expected it to be. Weather moving in, maybe. "Dafydd," his aunt said, leaning forward to look out between the still open plates. "Things are happening. Some news is about to break. I hoped we'd be able to put it off, but that was optimistic. Do what you can to stay out of trouble until I can get my arms around the situation." "I will. I promise." The plate slid closed, hiding her face. He never saw her again. Ricker Damatin took a last long drag on his cigarette, pinched it out, and threw the dead butt in a little ceramic public waste can before walking into the café. Littering the streets of Irvian would be a small, petty thing, and while he was feeling small and petty, little self-denials like this helped him feel virtuous. He found that he very much wanted to feel virtuous, more noble than those who had cast him aside. The interior of the café had been grown in two levels. Half a dozen steps led up and to his right to a set of communal tables, crowded with friends and strangers, shoulder to shoulder as they watched a display showing what he assumed was the lead-up to some sporting event. They all had that kind of breathless tension. Walking ahead, Ricker found a set of smaller booths, each with a curtain of beads to give the sense of privacy, if not the actual thing. A few tables sat low to the floor, with people on cushions around them. He found some faces he'd hoped to see. The delegation from Dian Academy wasn't large, and he'd been away from home in his Irvian exile for 3 years now. He shrugged off his jacket and made his way to the little table where a handful of his old compatriots sat. As he took his place, a red-haired man he'd studied with in his first term filled a shot glass from a blue-green bottle and slid it across the table to him. Ricker sipped first, let the feeling of the alcohol and the taste of black licorice wash through his mouth, let the fumes rise up behind his nose, and then finished the rest of the shot in a swallow. "Rough morning," one of the others said. Ricker sighed behind his smile. "I've been a guest of our friends in security since daybreak." "Austad?" the red-haired man asked. "They don't think you killed him, do they?" Ricker pushed his shot glass back. As the red-haired man filled it again, he said, "No, they're aware that my life would be much better with him in it. Losing him like this is a shock for all of us. But, excuse the self-pity, it's career-ending for me. Not the best profile for a murder suspect." A dark-haired woman who was, he thought, part of the transformational chemistry group, shook her head. When she spoke,
she slurred. He was the best of us. No one profits losing a man like Samar.
True,
Rikar said. And some lose more than others. The red-haired man pushed back the filled shot glass. Rikar decided to take this one more slowly. Nothing would be made better by being drunk, but then nothing could be made much worse either. He leaned forward, legs crossed under the table, and went back over it all while the others chattered around him. There should have been some place he could have made a different choice, some decision that, in retrospect at least, he ought to have made differently. Maybe he would have been better off staying at Dian and not joining Tanner Fryce's project in the first place, except that the team was good. The project had borne fruit, and without it, he'd have been another minor scholar chipping at some less successful work. If only we hadn't done well, made no sense. He noticed that the drunk woman was talking, had been talking for a while. She was going on now about the existential unfairness of death, but just before that she'd said something else. He didn't get to see them.
Didn't get to see who?
She blinked slowly. Rikar tried again. You said he didn't get to see them.
See who?
The things, she said, as if that meant something. Rikar gestured his question. The others were looking at him now, all of them surprised.
You really have missed everything today, haven't you?
The red-haired man said. Rikar checked his system. It was still set to refuse interruptions, the way the security forces interrogator had insisted that it be. He went back to his base settings, and floodgates opened, more than 100 alerts, some from friends, some from journalists and newsletters he'd set his system to watch, half a dozen from his father, with reference out to the same reports he had in his own listings. Unknown objects may be vehicles. Interstellar visitors? Defense councils from 8 nations in emergency session urge calm. It felt like a joke, a prank, then like a kick in the chest. Rikar was breathless. He caught a glimpse of a familiar face in one report as he passed and spooled back to let it run. Lauren Morse, his face shining with exhaustion and perhaps mania. As he spoke, he made sharp staccato gestures like he was fighting with ghosts. We've been following the lensing effect for some time now, since shortly after it entered the solar system. We detected the presence of matter inside the effect only within the last day and a half. When we tried a targeted scan, the lensing effect collapsed. Maybe they saw we were watching them. I don't know. It's too early to say what exactly we're looking at here, but it's certainly... Morse's grin stretched taut. It's certainly interesting, isn't it? Rikar shifted to a related image. A star field with a scattering of dim spots highlighted. If he hadn't known to look, he wouldn't have seen them. 17 city-sized objects, broad on one end and tapering to an almost crystalline point. The surfaces of the things were faceted and polished, more like machines than living systems. Despite that, Rikar's mind kept trying to interpret them as some kind of animal skull. He lifted the shot glass halfway to his mouth and then put it down again. Is this? He couldn't find the words.
It's real, the red-haired man said. They showed up 3 hours ago like someone flipped a switch.
It's some kind of secret defense project, someone else at the table said, but Rikar wasn't paying enough attention to care who. And anyway, he recognized the sound of panicked denial when he heard it. He looked at the images again. 17 not quite identical mysteries floating in the void. The anger and self-pity he'd been swamped by just minutes ago were gone,
and something else was pressing against the inside of his mind like it was being inflated. He had a brief but vivid memory of being 7 years old at his grandmother's vineyard in Nordkur, looking into the night sky and seeing it for the first time as infinity towering above him like God, only worse, because it was real. Maybe this was what religious awe felt like. Maybe it was only fear. Either way, he was done drinking for the day. He looked around the cafe and saw the tension he'd felt coming in. He'd misunderstood it then. He was part of it now. "Have they said anything?" he asked.
"No, they haven't done anything," the red-haired man said. "But I think your work group's moment in the spotlight is over. This is going to be the only thing anyone's talking about now."
"Tanner will be disappointed," Rickard joked, and then laughed again when he realized it was true. Cynia found a live image from an observatory in Glen Cole and set her system to display it without analytic overlays. The 17 probes, or ships, or artifacts, floated on the face of the abyss with only a little false color enhancement to show the details of their surprisingly complex surfaces. Probes, or ships, or asteroids, or anomalies, or miracles. It seemed to Noel that any term failed in some nuance. His own system was set to scour the available inputs for analysis and commentary that was more than speculation and echoes. So far, he'd found very little that had any intellectual rigor, and what there was devolved into the need for further study. He found that more comforting than she did. He kept waiting for it to turn out to be something innocuous, something that didn't merit alarm. That kept not quite happening.
"Let me make you some tea," he said.
Cynia shook her head, refusing, and then a moment later said, "That would be good. Yes, thank you." Noel rose from the table and, pausing to kiss the top of her head, went to the kitchen. The house was silent. Even the voices from his system faded to a dim murmur by the time he reached the kitchen and started the kettle. The remnants of their breakfast still sat on the counter. His plate was clean. The yolks of her eggs had congealed into an intense yellow gel. He thought it would be time for food again soon, but he doubted she would eat. They had meant to spend the day in the garden, pulling weeds and sampling the soil for signs of split worms and agatha parasites. Outside the kitchen window, the sunlight was bright. Ravens hopped along the branches of the pecan tree just beyond Noel's yard, conferring with each other on the mysterious business of corvids. He wished they'd kept to the gardening plan. Whatever was happening out beyond the envelope of Asian skies, there was nothing he could do about it, and Cynia would be less frightened if she could put her hands in soil. He let the tea steep, poured it into a rough earthenware cup, and took it back to the main room. The 17 things glimmered in the darkness, their clarity and resolution growing sharper with each new scan that was applied to the image. He put the cup at his lover's elbow and sat beside her.